This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20.
Was this guy kind of untouchable, or had he done time?
Okay. Every detective for the state police had ever passed through sitting that desk that I was now sitting had tried to put this guy away, and nobody could ever do it. And I'm like, here we go. You know, I'm going to make a name for myself. And no credit to the auto theft guys. They were doing most of the work, right? They had adopted the case, but I'm a part of it. And we take this guy down, and I forget, like, we had all these storage units, and they were just knee-high piled with motherboard computers from cars. We'd have the National Insurance Crime Bureau guy run it, and it'd be every one of them stolen. We just found all kinds of stolen shit. So finally, we get this guy jammed up, and come to find out, our informant had fibbed about a couple things that were used in the affidavit for the very first search warrant.
Informant lied?
Oh, right. Imagine that.
I am shocked. Could have knocked me over with a feather.
Welcome to Game of Crimes.
Hola, 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 amigos, amigos, players, playerettes, dudettes, all people. We welcome you back to another scintillating, titillating, and, vacillating episode of Game of Crimes. Right, Murph?
That sounded kind of nasty.
Just got to learn the English language, bro.
We welcome dogs, cats, not snakes.
Now, what we do, if they're friendly snakes, we may have a story about a snake. I don't know. Oh, yeah. Before we get into the other stuff, I just read this online. One of the weird things the TSA people found at the airport was a lady was coming on with her emotional support snake.
Oh, give me a...
Anyway, hey guys, welcome back. Morgan Wright here, literally with my partner in crime, Steve Murphy.
Hi, everybody.
Again, for another exciting episode. Hey, before we get started, though, just some quick housekeeping. Remember, hit those Apple, Spotify reviews. 5 stars really helps us out. We really appreciate it, and we're going to do everything we can to earn those stars. So head on over to Apple, Spotify, hit those 5 stars, and the next thing you know, we'll all be stars. Everybody, you get a star, and you get a star, everybody gets stars.
We'll all be stars.
All right.
Except for the jackass who just posted on Chartable. He gave us 1 star. He says...
He didn't like cops.
Yeah, all law enforcement lies. What a moron.
Dude, please, don't save your star for something, you know. I guarantee you, dude never listened to a single episode. But you know what? Got to take the good with the bad.
Yeah, we'd protect his ass too.
Oh, that's
I got to clean up my language. I'm sorry.
Ah, that's all right. Okay, guys, also head on over to our website, gameofcrimespodcast.com. We've got good stuff up there. The book from our last episode. And we've got some other books coming up too. So we've got a British officer, a detective sergeant who worked a very long, complex cold case. She's going to be coming up in a couple of weeks. So we're excited for that. She's got a book out as well. Also, follow us on that thing they call social media, at Game of Crimes on Twitter, at Game of Crimes Podcast on Facebook, and the Instagram. But this year, Murph, this is the year of Patreon. That's where you have to be. Patreon.com/GameOfCrimes. Because after we get done doing this, we're recording one of our favorite segments, which is the Q&A. Yeah. We take all questions. We answer all sorts of stuff. We've got 911. What's your emergency? You can't make this shit up. We are just coming out now with episode 14 of The Real DA Narcos on The Real DA Narcos Cali Edition. So we're getting ready to wrap that up. There's only 2 episodes left.
Would you call this the climax?
No.
Sorry.
I know where you're going. Yeah.
I'm not going.
Episode 15 would be the. I thought the end of episode 12 might have been the climax, but Chris didn't fully take one for the team. And if you want to know what that means, head on over. Patreon.com/Game of Crimes. Folks, we really do. We put a lot of work into that. We've got some neat stuff coming up to our monthly Narcometer review. We just did Lethal Weapon, which technically was made around Christmas. It is not a Christmas movie like the greatest Christmas movie ever made, which was Die Hard, but we still reviewed it. Had a lot of good stuff in that one.
Yeah, it was the best it was closest thing I could find to a Christmas movie and cops.
Yeah, so head on over there, patreon.com/gameofcrimes. Hey, now, this is a show about crime. We talk about bad people doing bad things and bad people doing bad things to good people. We take the story seriously, but...
But you already know, we never take ourselves serious. And I will try and clean up my language here, so...
But I am going to take ourselves serious on one thing. We did get a comment, and what? I want to read this. This is about our episode with Natasha Herzig, episode 60.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to use her name, but let me tell you, this is what we live for. Because we put this episode out. It was about human trafficking, about how she was kidnapped off the streets, coming out of a restaurant and trafficked for a year and a half, and the damage it did to her and what she did to recover from it. So let me just read you this real quickly. It says, "Good afternoon, gentlemen. I hope this email finds you well and hope you and family had a wonderful holiday season." We did. Thank you very much. I'm hoping my email doesn't go too long. Doesn't matter. It's a great email. And I just wanted to sincerely thank you. Brief explanation. I'm an avid listener to your podcast. Yay. I had listened to the episode with Natasha, and as soon as I finished it, had my daughter listen to it. Right on. Fast forward a few months, my daughter and her friends went to a popular theme park in town during their Christmas break. After a few hours of walking around and enjoying some time together, they decided to stop in an eatery to get some lunch. As they were enjoying their lunch, a young girl, looking about their age, comes up to them and starts a conversation. She begins by saying that she thinks they're very pretty, tells them she's only 14 years old, and asked if she could hang out with them that day. As the conversation continues, she tells them she's actually 16, but almost 17 years old. Yeah, a couple question marks there. She also, out of the blue, says her mom actually works there at the theme park, and that's why she's there. She proceeds to ask them if they want to go to the front of the line to the theme park, where she can get them a fast pass from her mom that works there. She tells my daughter and her friends that all they have to do is go to the building behind the bathrooms, and they can each get a pass. I mean, already, Murph, I'm seeing, red signals. We got to go to what building behind where? Mm-hmm. That's the other thing they try to do, is they try to isolate you. With all this being said, I'm happy to say that my daughter's radar immediately went up, and she actually told me, "Mom, the first thing I thought of was Natasha's story." My daughter did notice one of her friends feel very uneasy about the whole situation, but their other friend was just thinking this stranger was being nice. Could that have been the case? Maybe, maybe not. My daughter's friends asked if she wanted to go with them to get a pass, to which she replied, "No, I won't be going." Eventually, my daughter and her friends were staying inside the eating establishment without rushing to go anywhere, and the individual ended up leaving. My daughter has always been very standoffish, doesn't trust people, maybe to a fault. I'm so glad to know that at least I know she was listening and paying attention to Natasha's story. I could not thank you enough for bringing the story to us, and thank you, Natasha. Take care, gentlemen, and thank you again. I mean, sorry, kind of a long intro, but it's like, wow.
Yeah, and you know what? So our listeners, we forwarded this to Natasha just to let her know she is making a difference. And she was gracious enough to respond. She said, "Thanks so much for sharing with me. Sometimes I wonder if what I'm doing is making a difference, because I don't always get to see how my story has helped others. But reading your email reminds me why I do what I do. It's never easy telling my story over and over again, but worth it if it saves one life." So Natasha, in my book, you just saved maybe 3 lives right there, young lady. So God bless you. Thank you for having the courage to tell your story, and please continue to do so.
Absolutely. So, man, what a great way to kick off, the episode. So, hey, the other thing we wanted to do too is we're kind of putting Small Town Police Blotter on pause just for a month, because we're testing out stuff you guys have asked for. So on Patreon.com/Game of Crimes, we do a case of the month. We go in depth, but people said, "Hey, can you give us an update of what's going on?" So Murph, I have an update for you, what's going on. And let me tell you, this one, remember we had Paul Crane and Abe Perez on about the capture of El Chapo, the real story, right?
Oh yeah. I know you're going to talk about.
Yeah. So they captured El Chapo's son, and they were going to extradite him to the United States, except guess what the cartel did, Murph?
Mm-hmm.
They went on a killing spree. Mm-hmm. A Mexico City federal judge halted the extradition. I was about to say execution. That would have been better. Mm-hmm. Halted the extradition of Joaquin El Chapo Guzman's son, alleged cartel drug dealer Ovidio Guzman, to the United States on Friday, a day after he was arrested in an intense operation in northern Mexico that led to the deaths of 29 people.
And see, this is the second time he's been captured. And if you remember, the first time, you know, calls were made and all of a sudden all of his troops came pouring out and they just took siege to the little town there. They take trucks and different vehicles and they block all the streets. You know, you can't get in or out, and they just go in and kill everybody. It's amazing. And that first time, there was actually a truce called between the law enforcement, the Mexican officials, and the bad guys. You know, and the Mexican officials agreed to it. And there were pictures. The stuff's online. You can see it for yourself. There were pictures of the bad guys shaking hands with the good guys. And it was all to get that little shitbird, you know, free. And so now this judge, you think he's corrupt? Well, it could be this. He's corrupt either way. But you know what? They might have his wife and his children in their hands and say, boy, you sign it, or you won't see these people again. So it's merciless what goes on down there. It's just horrible. You're right. Execution would have been much better.
So after Guzman's arrest in Culiacan on Thursday, chaos erupted in the city. The authorities asked citizens to seek refuge due to clashes. His arrest was the result of a lengthy operation which involved 200 special forces, at least 19 suspected gang members, and 10 military personnel died during violent clashes in the northern Mexico state of Sinaloa. After authorities arrested Guzman along with 21 others, no civilian deaths or injuries were reported. What does this tell you? The Sinaloa cartel, I mean, it goes back to the Tom Clancy novel, the Sinaloa cartel. I mean, to me, they're a clear and present danger. You know, and as these guys move to our border, which they're doing, as they're crossing our border, which they're doing, as they're doing operations across the border, which they're doing, as they're killing American citizens, trafficking and doing stuff, you know, maybe at some point we ought to do the old Tom Clancy thing, call them a clear and present danger. And if these guys think they're tough, you know, maybe we send down, you know, Kevin Holland. That's all we need is Kevin Holland.
I'll tell you what, man, I back him up 110%. I trust him. It's, you know, I was getting ready to say, I know two groups that could do it, and he was a member of both of them.
Yes, he was. But I think we just send Kevin, say, all right, guys, we're, you know, oh my God, they're serious. They're sending down a SEAL and a member of Special Mission Unit Delta. He won't say, he won't admit to Delta Force, just Special Mission Unit Delta.
Oh, it's hilarious. So I wonder what Mexican President Andres Lopez Obrador thinks about this. Are you going to go down and give him hugs instead of bullets?
Hugs, not bullets.
How are you protecting your citizens?
We'll see that. All right, guys. Well, hey, we just thought that was interesting. We've got some other stories coming up, but that one was topical because, you know, we obviously had the guys on that captured him. This is just something that happened recently. And look, I mean, if you don't think it's dangerous, if you don't think drugs aren't dangerous, you don't think human trafficking's not dangerous, what these guys do, these guys, I think at some point they're going to have to make a finding. They are a clear and present danger to the safe national security of the United States. And we'll see.
You know what? And just to put a little tease out there, we're working on getting a guest on here who was one of the creators of the Delta Force in the Army. He was a Ranger, Green Beret, Special Forces. I'm not going to tell you his name now. He's a retired general now. We worked with him in Colombia.
Well, Murphy, you've just given everybody
been
clues.
Friends
this
all
thing
these years.
Google.
He is. I tell you what, man. You talk about a patriot. I'm just waiting to hear back from him. But you guys are. If we can get him on here, you're going to love it. You're going to love. And then we can ask him about this. What's his thoughts about going to Mexico?
All right. Well, hey, let's get this thing going. Before we do that, though, just one more quick thing. Got to make sure you've gone over to Game of Crimes Fans. Head on over to that group, Game of Crimes Fans. Our favorite mafia queen, Sandy Salvato, will grant entry if you're worthy, if you just answer a couple questions. Get on over there, join us in the fun, and see what's going on behind the scenes, behind the scenes, as we discuss and do fun stuff over there. So Game of Crimes Fans, just look for it on Facebook, answer a couple questions. Even if you're in the ballpark, yeah, you're going to get in. Just be kind, be cool. What did Matta say? Be calm, be cool, or be calm, be courteous, but have a plan to kill everybody in the room.
That's exactly right. And I'm a little worried because I'm looking at our Q&A for today, and I see one from Sandy. And
No. You can't get into the Q&A yet. That's Patreon. You got to be on Patreon
What
we got there.
Looking at the wrong one. Sorry.
All right, well, let's close this one up, too, because we have got a real comedian on. You think that we're comedians? No, we brought a real comedian on, but he got his his start, his honorable start in law enforcement as a state trooper, which just galls Merv to no end. How can a state trooper be this good, this funny? And he is.
Well, most of you troopers are funny. I mean, I have to say that. But and this guy, though, he was assigned to their investigative division. So he wasn't out there changing tires and getting
long
gas
enough
for people.
He wore the uniform, wore it proudly, wore the round.
I tell you what, though, this is – it's there are so many comedians in law enforcement, you know, and most of it is off-color humor. So it's kind of hard to bring those people on here. But our guest today, Todd, good Irishman, Todd McComas, has made a career out of this. And the people that he hung out with, I mean, I was watching Pat McAfee on TV last night before the football game. I mean, just this is what a heck of a career after
talk about a crime scene. That was a crime scene last night.
So I really think you guys are going to love this guy. And we'll go ahead and tell you right up front here, if you ever get a chance to see his comedic act, you definitely want to do it.
He has got, in fact, we're going to talk about it because a lot of the comedy comes from real life, mm-hmm. You know. I tell you, the fact is stranger than fiction. So
can't make your shit up. Oh, wait a minute. That's our Patreon thing.
That's our other one. Yeah, don't talk about that one either, Murph. You got to be on patreon.com/gameofcrimes.
Talk about 199?
Yeah, we'll talk. We're going to have a special episode just for you on that. So, hey, guys, but we can't hear from Todd unless I ask you, Murph, are you ready to play the biggest, baddest, most dangerous game of all, the funny one? Game of Crimes.
Oh, yeah. Everybody, you're going to love this. So get in, sit down, shut up, and hold on. Let's hear from our comedian friend, Todd McComas.
Oh, if this is any indication, this is going to be good because Murph's first question is, how did you qualify to carry with a taser, to carry a taser? And you know those are always good stories. So, hey, before we get started, we're going to give a shout out to Lou Veloze, who was actually episode 4, I do believe. On our list. Was that right, Murph? Episode 4?
Damn, has he been? Yeah, absolutely.
Yes,
I didn't realize it's been that long ago.
Lou was our first 2-part episode. So Lou gave us the introduction into this next man who, by the way, Murph, state trooper.
Oh, God.
Yeah, welcome, hey, Todd McComas.
Let me tell our listeners right now, go and get your pillows out. We got two troopers on here talking. We're going to talk about changing tires and getting people gas and directions and, you know, making sure their car is all cleaned up.
And making sure the DEA agents found their way back to the office after they left their gun in the restaurant.
That's true. That's very true.
That happened to Murph, yeah.
This might be a long interview, everyone.
So, hey, welcome, Todd McComas.
Woo-hoo. Hey, thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
No, man, this is going to be good. I love having you on here, Todd. Thank you for giving us the time today. And when our listeners find out what you're doing now, you're going to see why we're excited to have you on here today.
Well, and Todd gets props for having the most professional setup, I think, of any guest we've had on. He's got the professional mic, the Shure MV5. He's got the headset. I assume that's all going into a mixer as well.
It is. This is my full-time gig behind me. I'm a professional podcaster, if you will. Mm-hmm. So we can get into that later.
But absolutely.
I got an old school mixer, the Yamaha. Just, you know, nothing fancy, just good and reliable. I can probably throw it up against this wall, pick it up, plug it back in. It's going to be fine. It's like an old Colt 1911, you know?
Well, the question is, do you know what all those freaking buttons do? Because I've got like 87 buttons here, and I know what maybe 4 of them do.
I do. My son is like a whiz kid. He is a big time producer for the Pat McAfee Show, video audio guy. He's taught me. He's taught me a lot. You know, I'm a dinosaur, so you know, I can. Pat, I have a limit.
Which show does he do?
Pat McAfee Show. Yeah. Really?
You're nice. Kidding.
No. Yeah. He runs their YouTube channel.
The sports analyst, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you ought to see him on game day, ESPN game day.
He's the best thing that's ever happened to game day. Oh, he's so good on there.
He is so irreverent. But he's got good analysis, too. But, you know, I'm a huge college football fan, and he has just so much fun going on there. Wow, that's neat.
Yeah.
Very cool. See, there is life after law enforcement.
There is. Lou Veloze, though, that you brought up, this guy. Now, he kind of changed my whole network. Like, I had my own network after 21 years in law enforcement that I had built. And then when I met Lou Veloze, he started introducing me to all the coolest long-term infiltration undercover guys I had ever met. And now you, of course, and I'm a big fan of you and what you've done. So this guy, he looks like probably somebody that, you know, he's in the wrong era, because he should probably be cast in like Grease Lightning, something, you know, Happy Days maybe, as the guy.
No, he needs to be in a motorcycle movie, you know, an outlaw motorcycle gang movie.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's Guido through and through, right?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
I mean, he drips pepperoni.
Yeah, he about a month or 6 weeks ago, he called, and he and his wife were over in Melbourne, Florida, and my wife and I live in Orlando. So we went over and had brunch. You know, I didn't even know Lou would know what the word brunch meant, you know. And so we're sitting there in the parking lot, and I'm calling him like, dude, I'm here. Where are you? And he comes pulling up in his black Dodge Ram pickup truck. And I thought, and I'm sitting there in my black Ford F-150 truck. I thought, that's my brother right there pulling in the lot.
I have a going black F-150 as well.
There you go.
Oh, well, I didn't get the memo. I've got a gray Kia Telluride. So,
you know, yeah, Lou, tell you too, Lou, Morgan. I'm sorry to interrupt you there. Our listeners, most of our listeners know this. We can see each other as we record this, but we only play the audio for our listeners. But I can see Morgan. You need a freaking haircut, dude. Look like crap.
You're just jealous. No, I'm letting it grow. I have never grown my hair out this long ever in my life. So it's like, I'm letting it go.
Morgan, you were a state trooper for how long?
Well, I was between working the road and investigations and at a PD, it was 18 years. But yeah, you know what it's like. You got to keep your hair short, especially if you're in the shirt and tie. And we didn't have policies back in the day. When I got on the state patrol, I started off on the Salina Police Department in 82. We weren't allowed to have mustaches, nor were we allowed to go to bars. Our chief of police said no. Then when I got on the state patrol, it was only halfway during our training where the colonel, we got a new colonel, finally relented and said, okay, you can have a mustache, but can only come down the corners of your mouth. And that was it. That was being progressive back in 1984.
It was the same way here for our road troopers in 1990 through when I left. Like, you could only have, and you're like, you know, there was a guy with a very short mustache that's not very popular in history. And the mustache that you will allow us to wear very much resembles his mustache. It's the old Marine Corps style, you know, corner to corner, but it's very Hitlerish when it can't go to, you know, past the edges of your mouth.
Yeah.
Hey, by the way, you must know Mel Carraway.
I do.
A very good friend of mine. When I was doing work at the Department of Justice, Mel was the superintendent of the Indiana State Police, and he was running the National Criminal Intelligence Sharing Program while I was running the Law Enforcement Information Sharing Program. So I got to know Mel before he punched out and went to TSA and started doing the government stuff.
Mel Carraway, quite possibly the biggest-hearted, nicest superintendent the Indiana State Police ever has ever had, and like world class opera singer. Like, it was crazy. Really? You don't know this?
I didn't know that.
World class opera singer. He goes all over the world, or at least he used to sing opera. It was crazy. Wow. Yeah, yeah. He performed for a thing we had once, and we were like, oh my God, why is this guy our superintendent? He should be traveling. Making.
See, more like a baritone or a tenor or what?
Baritone.
Okay.
As I recall, but very, very good. I mean, like, I don't know that they come any better at opera than that guy. I mean, he was world class.
I wish I would have known that. It would have made a couple of the meetings far more interesting.
Talk about hidden talents, you know, everybody's got some. This guy, you're like, what? Yeah, beautiful singing voice.
Well, speaking of hidden things, before we can get into some of your deep, dark secrets, we got to figure out, like we always do, Cosa Nostra, thing of ours. How did you get started in this thing? I mean, like I asked some people, were you drunk one night, got thrown in front of a barracks and, you know, raised your right hand and joined up? I mean, how did family involved? I mean, got arrested as a Ute, fractured a few laws. How did you get started?
I definitely was not one of those that can say I grew up knowing this is what I always wanted to do. Like, I had no inclination whatsoever, even going like into college, that this is what I wanted to do. I had no one in my family that had ever done it, that at least that I know of. I wanted to make funny beer commercials. Like, you know, when I was in high school in the 80s, the beer commercials and the Cola War commercials were like, that's an era of TV
Tastes great. Less filling. Tastes great.
Everybody was in such competition trying, and they did so by like who had the best commercials. And I just remember falling in love with all these great beer commercials that you'd see, you know, ultimately you waited all year to see which one was going to be on the Super Bowl. And I wanted to go into advertising. I got accepted at the University of Texas to go major in advertising. Here was my problem though. When I was in high school, I was, I don't know what kind of language you use on this show. Do I need to be?
Dude, we are a HR free zone. Let them fly.
Okay. I was kind of a fuck off like in high school, right? I was a good athlete for a smaller county school. And I was, I guess, smart enough that I didn't really have to ever study to get by with like a B average.
How big was your high school?
I think my graduating class was 339 people.
Okay.
So, you know, smaller, not like the TV show Hoosiers or the movie Hoosiers small, but smaller. And I just never really had any discipline and I knew it. And I was so concerned that later in life, I was going to be a problem for myself, like not being able to keep a job. And my dad was the pillar of the hardworking American and great dad and the provider, right? And I wanted to be that. So I made a conscious decision. I screwed off a little baseball scholarship at a small-time junior college in Indiana. And my parents had moved to Texas, so I joined them. And
now, did your parents move to Texas while you were in high school because you were such a problem child?
Well, it turned out it definitely one fed the other, or I don't know which came first, the chicken or the egg. But I spent my whole senior year living with two friends and no parents because my dad got transferred to Texas and I talked them into letting me go back to Indiana to finish my senior year because I was going to be shortstop that year. You know, they tried to move me to Matthew McConaughey's high school. And it was a huge Texas school, you know, where guys go pro right after high school, you know, and I'm like, I'm not going to get a play. I spent my whole life to be, you know, this one year. And so they let me go back and man, that was a mistake. I missed like 40 days of school. I was the worst, you know, I was fun. Everybody loved me. I was the class clown and, you know, and all that stuff, but I barely graduated because of my attendance problem. And so I took all this into account and I made a responsible decision for myself. I was like, hey, my dad was a Marine during Vietnam. Everyone in my family had served in the military. I'm going to go into the Marine Corps because if there's one thing I know from the outside looking in about the Marine Corps is they give you discipline. Like you don't come out of the Marine Corps undisciplined. So I'm going to go. And I did, and that kind of changed my life because.
Did you go to California or North Carolina?
Yeah, I was a Hollywood Marine. I went to San Diego for boot camp.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah. It was. I mean, nice weather, terrible experience. Like I don't know if I'd ever do it again. It's one of those things. You're proud you did it, but I'd never do it again. I mean, it's boot camp. It was horrible. But when you get out, you know, you're just a proud Marine and, you know, and I had the discipline I was missing. I had work ethic now to match all the other attributes. I wasn't so much a fuck off. And they made me a military policeman. So while I was an MP, now I went in as a reservist. I had to do a year active duty because of the Gulf War. So I never made it to the Gulf. I actually went to Norway because that's where they like send the really, really good Marines like as far away geographically from the actual war as possible.
Yeah, I don't think that's where they send the really good Marines, but you just stick with that, pal.
That's what I told myself. Hey, we're here to protect Christmas. We're going to guard the North Pole. We're not going
to protect Russia from invading. Yeah, that's what we're here for.
Well, at least you understood the assignment, right?
Right. So we go up there and freeze our asses off. And then I come back and I spend the rest of the time basically guarding aircraft and saluting blue stickers and waving in cars at a gate for a year in South Carolina. But because I was in this reserve unit based out of Dallas, Texas, because that's where my parents lived and that's where I went after high school, I had a bunch of regular cops, state troopers, Dallas cops, you know, other kind of law enforcement officers, all in my reserve unit. And we took over this whole base because all the active duty people were stuck in the Gulf. So I'm getting to hear these crazy stories because, you know, we're bored. We're just sitting out there guarding aircraft in the middle of the night, you know. By the way, not one jet got stolen during my whole tour there.
Excellent.
So I was very good at my job.
Ask Murph about his time on the railroad police. Nobody stole a train either, man. He was good. Right.
Saved every single one of them.
Very similar assignments, I would guess.
Well, speaking of assignments, I know you said you've guarded jets and all that good stuff. Did you ever guard any gates?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, big gate.
Did any gates get stolen during your time?
Not a single gate. And no one ran my gate. They were very respectful of my gate when it was my shift, when they saw me there. The do you know what the Swans is? The Swan Man? Do you have that where you guys are?
Schwan.
Schwan, yeah. So the Schwan Man would throw me an ice cream sandwich every time he came through. I mean, he knew the deal. This is my gate.
Great little pizza. By the way, Schwan's and part of Tony's Pizza, that was right down the road from where one of their biggest facilities was in Salina, Kansas. So when I was going through the academy, we'd run up and down. We used to be in the old Minute Manor, which was the Air Force Base there. It used to be Schilling Air Force Base. And we'd run up and down. It was called the Scanlon Run, the Scanlon Mile, which was a 3-mile run. But we'd get down there, turn around, Schwan's Pizza, and their big plant was right there. So we'd get those little, you know, the small pizzas and get the ice cream sandwiches. It was, living large, baby.
I grew up on Schwan. My mom just, our entire kitchen cabinets were just in refrigerator was full of Schwan stuff. But so I got out of the Marine Corps finally.
Well, one more question about your time in the Marines before you move on. Did you ever guard any nukes though? Fast. I think they called it fast.
No nukes. I was pretty much spent all my time at Marine Corps Air Station in Beaufort, South Carolina, which is a great location because it's kind of a low profile Marine Corps base, right? It's smaller, but yet it's got cool enough stuff. We had a beach, our own beach. We were in between Myrtle Beach and Hilton Head. So on the weekends, you know, we had two and a half hour any direction.
There goes your discipline, right?
Oh, yeah. And where all my money. I mean, I was broke 2 days after payday every time.
Yeah, that's which they used to call it. I don't know what they call it in the Marines and the Army. We used to call it the E3 Mafia, you know. But yeah, you'd buy your first vehicle at like 22% interest, and all your money would go to paying for your vehicle.
Oh yeah, and you end up, you know, the pawn shops there are great because all these dumb E3s, these lance corporals are running around buying shit they can't afford, and then the next month they got to take it back to the pawn shop and sell it at 10% of its original value. You know, God, those guys make a fortune. But by the time I was done with my assignment and released back to reserve status, I had to make a decision. Okay, school got interrupted there, right? What am I going to do? So I was like, oh, let's reroute things. These stories were so stuck in my head, these cool pursuit stories and bank robbers and all this stuff that these Dallas cops were throwing around to me for a year over beers. I was like, I want that. I want to have those stories when I'm all done, right? So I'm going to try to become a cop. I went to school for criminal justice, and I did not finish. I left my junior year over a girl, of course, but I started applying my ass off to be a cop, and after a lot of departments turned me down, I ended up getting on the Indiana State Police.
So when you were in Dallas, I'm going to tie the name in, but you probably never heard of a guy named Dave Gaddis, did you?
No.
Dave was one of the guests on our show. He's one of Murph's friends, DEA, but he started off as a Dallas cop. His first day on his own, when he got released from training, a naked guy high on meth climbed in through his window and started attacking him. That was his first day on the job in Dallas.
That sounds about right.
I thought that was
wasn't that Dave?
I thought it was Guy Hargraves.
Oh, no, that's right. Guy Hargraves. I'm sorry. Yeah, Guy Hargraves. Guy ended up actually doing polygraphs for the CIA and ended up doing a case out in Kansas. The largest LSD factory in the world was in a old missile silo in Wamego, Kansas.
You know, that was always one of my biggest fears, was having to fight a naked guy. Because, you know, I'm just like, and I was a good wrestler in school.
I mean, what do you grab?
That's the question. And that's my thing. Like, I was not, like, boxing wasn't really my thing, you know, but I was a really good wrestler. But I'm like, now you're taking my greatest tool away from me. Because
I was a wrestler, too. And that's the thing is you start doing, like, you want to do a leg ride or reach down and do a crotch lift. It's like, oh, yeah, God, no.
Right? I mean, everything you've been taught as a wrestler immediately puts your face where you don't want it to be. Right?
Or your hand.
I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with that. You know, it depends.
Oh, he's sweaty there. Oh, my God. Oh.
Okay. So why are pubic hairs curly, Murph?
I have no idea.
Because if they were straight, they'd poke you in the eye. That's why you don't want your face down there. Anyway, bad joke. Yes, you're the comedian here. We're going to have to get to the real funny stuff, too. So how many departments would you say you applied to before the Indiana State Police finally recognized your true value?
I want to say a dozen. And, you know, I'm going to give myself a little bit of credit. Not that I was a bad applicant. I don't think that was the era, man, where that was the heyday. Like,
there was like 2,000 people applying for 10 jobs.
I competed against 2,700 and some applicants on the Indiana State Police for 85 slots for an academy class.
There were 2,000 in Kansas that applied for my academy class. They only hired 16 of us.
Oh, wow. Yeah. And those numbers, you know, during that, those numbers have never been that high since. They've just, you know, steadily declined for obvious reasons. But
what year was that?
That was 1994. No, 95. 95, sorry. Yeah. Our class was August of 95. And those numbers have, you know, that was the peak. Like, and it was everywhere, you know. And that was also that era where, for good reason, you know, affirmative action came in to try to correct percentages of numbers of, you know, a lot of departments, especially here in Indiana, were way upside down in their numbers, and there weren't enough people of color getting positions. So for just a regular white dude like me, it was harder to get on then than probably ever before. So it was quite, I almost gave up. Like I had hit the point where I'd had a job. You know, I'm in Indianapolis and I got a job. And if you take you back to me wanting to go into advertising, I was kind of an art kid in school. And so I'd gotten a job like at this vinyl graphics place right next to the Indy 500 on Gasoline Alley. You know, we decaled the Indy cars and NASCAR once that came here. And it was a cool job and it paid well, you know, and our boss was from New Zealand. We could drink beer during the day while we were working, and, you know, and I'm 24. Like, it was great. And I had almost given up. I was like, you know what? Being a cop's just, it's too hard. I'm just going to give up. And then I saw an ad for the Indiana State Police and I was like, all right, one more try. If I don't get this, I'm done forever. I'm just going to take off in this career that I'm in. And I got it, you know, and it changed everything, I guess.
Yeah. Let's talk about your academy. How long was your academy?
6 months.
Now, did you guys stay, were you required, was that you were on site Monday through Friday, or did you have to stay all 7 days?
We were there Monday through Friday, so we would go home on the weekends.
Yeah,
if you were, you know, some people stayed because they came from far away.
Right.
But yeah, I went home every weekend. You know, at the time I was living with the girl that I dropped out of college with, who ended up being my son's mother one day. We got married while I was in the academy, actually. Like early on, like a month and a half into the academy, I went home for the weekend, got married, honeymooned, I think, that night in little bitty Brown County, Indiana, in a little cabin there that the plumbing didn't work. And then I went back, you know, Sunday night to start.
Sounds like stories of an E3 weekend back in the Marines.
Yeah, it didn't bother me a bit. I was fresh out of the Marine Corps. I'm like, yeah, no, this is the way life is supposed to be.
Way it's supposed to be.
She didn't like it much, but yeah.
So now you were talking about like going through the academy and stuff. How many people were in your class? If you remember,
I believe we started with 85.
Do you remember how many you ended up with?
We ended up with 83 graduating, but that's only because we were the first riverboat class. We had just gotten gaming approved, right? So the gaming commission, or at least these people that were paying all this money to have licenses to put riverboat casinos up, were paying a lot of money into the state then. And our whole class was funded from that money. So it, whenever someone didn't got booted for some reason, they had a list of alternates and brought them in. So they wanted to take complete advantage of that money and make sure, you know, typically you would not replace them, right? And if you started with 85, you might graduate 50. But every time somebody got kicked out for whatever reason, at least in that first phase, they would bring in a replacement. So it was, yeah, some people just quit. Obviously, they realize a couple of days in, now this is not what I want to do. I'm in the wrong place. So I think we went through a dozen, maybe closer to 20 people that got replaced.
Oh, wow. And you replaced them with another 20.
Yeah. So we graduated with 83. And we were, to my knowledge, it's the biggest class we've ever graduated. And it was weird for the state police, too, because I don't know what people know of Indiana. Indiana has Indianapolis. And then a couple other cities, Evansville, South Bend, Fort Wayne.
Well, you know, I used to live in Mishawaka. My dad taught ROTC out at Notre Dame during the Vietnam era. So,
well, there you go. You know, it's like we got like a handful of mid-level cities, and then Indianapolis, our big city, and the rest of Indiana is cornfield and country. Like, so 83 new troopers get released into the world, you know, at the same time. And I know like 12 of us went to this little bitty district, the Versailles district, the Southeast Indiana. We call it Kentuckiana because you can't really tell, you know, where Kentucky ends and Indiana starts there. It's real, real kind of hill jack, you know, and that we doubled the force there at that post. There was only, I think, 14 troopers there, including, you know, command personnel. And then 18 rookies go there.
So and you know what happens with that? Here's the bad part. All of these people get used to a way of life to where there's just like a few troopers out. Now there's double the number of troopers. Anything that moves is subject to being stopped and cited.
That community got terrorized. I mean, they, you know, and to double that with, you know, the troopers that were there loved being there. It was kind of the retirement post, you know, not that stuff didn't happen, but you just kind of loved to be there. So they were all veterans and they were out, you know, stopping cars at an alarming rate. And then you flood them with 18 rookies full of piss and vinegar. And all of a sudden the same car gets stopped three times trying to get from the mom and pop grocery store to home for not having a light on their license plate. You know, it's just, it was terrible. And we end up, our whole class goes to the riverboat. We, part of our agreement that we signed going into the academy was that we would work at least 1 year on the riverboat because they didn't know how to staff them with law enforcement yet. They hadn't really fully formed the gaming enforcement arm of the gaming commission. So they have this brilliant idea. Oh, let's stick a bunch of fresh state troopers on these boats. You know, by the way, there was no education given. We knew nothing about gaming laws or how to regulate, you know, these companies to make sure they were abiding by what they were supposed to, you know, regulation wise. And we wanted to be out arresting bad guys, right? We were fresh out of the academy. And there's not a lot of action on a riverboat, you know, during the day on a Monday. You basically just sit up there and watch old people shit themselves at the slot machine, you know, and pass out. Like every shift, one or two old ladies would pass out because they're 90 and they wouldn't eat because they're waiting. I'm not leaving this machine. I know it's going to hit. And they would lose consciousness. Like
that was a scam. They were waiting for you young, good looking troopers to come down and do mouth to mouth on them.
Oh,
okay. It was very uneventful and we all hated it.
Did you have to be in uniform for that?
No, they made us go shirt and tie, which first of all, this was another bad decision on their part, I thought. We were broke. You know, an Indiana State Trooper at that time, rookie, made $22,000 a year. And we had to go buy enough coat, tie, suits to last us a year, right? So you got to buy at least 6-7 suits. We're all broke. A lot of us had young kids. You know, I was on government assistance to buy formula for my son. And now I got to buy this whole new wardrobe. So I'm on the gaming boat and bored out of my mind. And there was finally, you know, I just waited and waited and waited and waited for just 1 ounce of action. I 13 months on that boat, I had two incidents, you know, where actually I got to be a policeman for a minute. One, they almost fired me for. So I'm working.
No,
up
no,
there.
You don't get to gloss past that. Let's talk about the incident you almost got fired for.
So I'm sitting in my office, just watching the cameras like I do, probably playing solitaire, you know, or whatever. We didn't have a lot of games on computers back then. And in fact, I think we were the first office to actually get a computer for the Indiana State Police, if I remember right, because we had gaming money. So I'm sitting there and I'm probably playing solitaire, bored out of my mind. And I remember being scared to death by this boom, 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 boom on our office door. Now, the security office was directly across from our office. So I run over and I open the door and they're like, get down here quick. And I'm like, okay. So I'm just like, go, I'll follow you. Yell what I need to be doing as we're going. Because I thought, man, is somebody dying? You know, this is a big deal. This guy's excited. Well, evidently a guy had just walked up to this old lady and just snatched her whole bucket of tokens in the slot area, and then exited the boat. And the rule at that time in Indiana was gaming couldn't happen until the boat had left the dock and was actually cruising on the river. Now, you couldn't really cruise because it's that stretch of the Ohio River. You can't even get the boat that size to turn around. You just have to go up and back. So you're forward and reverse at this short little stretch. But that meant you were cruising, so it fit the statute. So this guy runs off with this bucket of tokens from this old lady he just mugged and goes out into the pavilion, down the ramp into the pavilion, and I chase after him, and I yell right as I'm leaving the boat to the pavilion. I'm like, have them hold this boat. I was the only gaming agent on the boat, so it's not allowed to cruise without me. So I'm like, tell the captain, hold the boat till I get back. I run this guy down like a champion, by the way. I was young and I was fast. I go all the way to this pavilion, three levels, catch the guy as he's trying to get out the door, tackle him, cuff him up, call for the Lawrenceburg Police Department to come get him. So I'm sitting on this guy for like 20, 25 minutes till this is all done. And then I walk up all proud. You know, I'm a young state trooper. I finally got to be a cop for a minute. And I get on the boat and I'm like, all right, Captain, you can cruise now. So they closed the doors and went about their business. The next day, I am awoke from a dead sleep because that was a night shift. And I have to report to their main office down there off the pavilion. So I go down there and I'm informed that I quite possibly am about to lose my job because I delayed a cruise on this gambling boat that I have no authority to do. And I'm like, what in the hell are you talking about? There was a crime. This guy pushed this old lady down, took her money, and ran off. And you're telling me that I'm in trouble because I chased him down and provided her justice and got her money back and put him in jail like where he should be because I delayed that boat 20 minutes from cruising? He said, that's exactly what I'm telling you. And I'm like, this is the craziest shit I've ever heard. So and they were dead serious.
Who's this guy telling you this shit?
Well, it's coming from the top. I won't say, you know, who the ultimate bosses were at that point, but this is coming from the top. My boss, just the middleman, right? And he's telling me, I agree, this is crazy, but I ain't going to lose my job. You only been here for like 6 months, you know? Ultimately, he's telling me, I don't give a shit. I'm not fighting this, right? So it becomes this big deal, and the news steps in, and then stories start leaking of all this, like how ethical and how right is this thing that the Indiana State Police has signed up to do. And this story leaks about my thing, right? Of course, I helped leak it eventually. So,
true confessions on Game of Crimes. It was me.
Right. So, this story leaks from an anonymous source about a gaming agent.
Not so anonymous trooper, anymore.
Right. Who saved this old lady and, you know, did this great thing and was maybe going to get fired because it's more important that we collect state money on taxes from gambling, right? So that gets fixed eventually and whatever. And it does get better. You know, the life of the gambling boat is definitely something that's embraced now. Like it's a beautiful thing for people at the end of their career. It's a great place. You get paid a little more, right? And then it transitions into, oh, when you want to retire as a state detective, you can now just become a gaming enforcement agent for the same money, keep all your retirement time and all this stuff. So it has evolved into a very much a good thing, but its beginnings were really, really questionable.
See, and you were about to gloss over this whole story. We just don't allow that to happen. It's like we're going, and then blah, blah, blah. No, anytime somebody goes blah, 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 that's where the gold is. Hey, real quick question though. What did you end up charging the guy with, like aggravated robbery, or do you remember what you charged him with?
I believe he pled down from robbery to theft, and maybe even got, if I remember right, that was my first introduction into like fast food justice. I pled down to alternative misdemeanor sentencing, you know, as long as he didn't get arrested for a year. It would bump down to a misdemeanor version of theft. Yeah, some bullshit. But
that's exactly right. You said it right. It's bullshit.
But, you know, what can we do? We do our job. We let the courts do theirs, you know. But, it became a big deal. That and a couple other stories guys were involved with. But I got the hell out of there. First opportunity. And by the way, this is how I got out of there. I had only done 15 months on the road. Total of my career, right? So I do 6 months total, counting my FTO period before I go on the boat. I do 13 months on the boat, and then I'm released back to the road as a trooper finally for another 6 months. I only get 6 months, really, 6 or 7 months on the road when I had put in for a detective job in Indianapolis. And I only did that because older guys at the post would, you know, thump us on the head and say, hey, dummy, go take all the tests. You got to practice. You're not going to get promoted for 10 years. Don't worry about that. But you need to get good at interviewing and taking the tests and qualifying for promotion and all that stuff. So I see, you know, I'm from the district, the Indianapolis district. I'm from one of the counties that's within that district. That's where I grew up. So I'm like, oh, my wife's always wanted to go back there. I know I want to be a detective. You know, I did not want to stay in uniform.
What, so, did you come to that realization only after it was like, if they had not started you off on the riverboat and started you right on the road, would you have had a different desire to stay on the road for a while?
You know, I did not hate the road. I did have a blast. We were in small town Indiana where they needed us as a state, as state police should be used. We were there to cover the holes that local law enforcement had,
yeah,
right?
A lot of them were not full service. They were Monday through Friday, 8 to 5.
Oh, yeah. And a lot of our towns, like 2-3 cop towns, maybe a town marshal and a couple volunteer deputies. So when something big happened, they needed us. And I loved that role. So I really did have a good time. But I could remember, man, that, you know, they had murders and all that stuff happen in our district. And when I would see the detectives working on stuff, I was like, I want to do what that guy's doing. That guy knows what's going on. You know, that's big deal TV cop stuff. I want to be doing that. So I put in for the detective position. There was a shit ton of applicants because Indianapolis was a big post and, you know, that was a popular spot.
Now, did you apply for the position or a position within a particular squad like robbery or auto theft, or did you just apply for the position?
You applied for the position and the geographical assignment back then. So we did have specialty investigation units, but it was also usually tied to you have to live in one of these four counties, right? So, or this part of the state. And this particular assignment to be a detective at that post, you had to live in one of four counties, Marion, which is Indianapolis, or the little donut counties around it. So I wanted to go back to Shelby County where I was from eventually, which is one of the donut counties. So I put in for it. Long story short, I get the job. I don't have 2.5 years on. And I beat out like all these people that, you know, with 15 years on and stuff, and people are pissed. They're like, what? The guys that told me to put in for it were pissed because a lot of them wanted to be detectives at one point and they haven't been able to do so yet. And they're like, what the hell, dude? And I'm like, I don't know. You told me to go take the test and put in for it.
So what was your secret?
I don't know. I don't know why they like me. In retrospect, it worked out well. I had a great career and I did well for them, but I was too young. I was 26 years old with maybe 2.5 years on as a cop. Most of that, half of that,
13 months
was
on the river.
Yeah. Not being a cop, right? So really, we look at it, I had a year of cop experience. And now I'm thrust into our biggest assignment as a detective. Really, I mean, Indianapolis is the real deal, you know, for Indiana cop life. So I get it and I go there and I just start to figure it out. And I, fortunately, what little cop time I had where I was broke in, because we were kind of lone rangers out there on our own, we did a lot of investigations, you know, for road troopers. We had to work our own burglaries and stuff. So I did have, turns out I had more investigative experience than a lot of road troopers with 15 years on in Indianapolis, because they're primarily highway patrol. Because it's flooded with police departments with plenty of resources. So they don't really need the uniform guys there. So they just stick to the interstates pretty much. So it worked out. I quickly fell into it. And I think I was a natural. I had some good mentors.
What was your favorite cop show during that time?
So that would have been
Miami Vice.
98.
No, please.
I did like me some Miami Vice.
There you go. See?
I'm trying to think what else was on in like 97, 98, but Miami Vice had to be one of the biggest ones for sure. I remember even going back a little further, I liked Hill Street Blues a lot.
That's always a standard, yeah.
Yeah, because that was kind of the first kind of
Sergeant Esterhaus, let's roll and let's be careful out there.
Right. But I fell quickly into some cool cases there. I remember I learned real quickly that don't shy away from any case. You know, like if you get, you're a general crimes detective here for the Indiana State Police, you're going to work probably every statute in the book if you're there long enough. So you would get sometimes things thrown at you that you're like, I have no idea. I've never attended a class.
That's
or any
a violation of law. Oh my God. I didn't know that.
Right. Like I got thrown into this vehicle crimes case with altered and cloned vans, all this shit. And I was like, I don't know how to do this stuff, but I'm keeping the case. Nobody's going to take it from me. So I called the auto theft guys and I'm like, hey, will you come down here and teach me up a little bit? And then they came down and they saw the case I had and they're like, hey, this is huge. Like this might end up being like one of the biggest cases we've ever had in the state of Indiana for this kind of stuff. And I'm like, oh shit. Okay.
So give us the real quick context. What was going on? What was the scam? What was the crime? What made it the biggest kind of case?
There was this, when I became a detective there, this was a gift, by the way. My sergeant immediately takes me to the Shelby County Sheriff's Department, which, by the way, was 5 minutes from where I had moved to. And he introduces me to the captain, and he says, this is your desk. They had three detectives, and there were four desks. And he said, this is the state police desk. You're taking this guy's desk that just retired, and now you will work here. And this guy, my sergeant, was from Shelby County. He said, you will never take a case from the Indiana State Police. You will only take cases from that captain. You will provide him with services he can't provide himself, and you're his state police guy. And I was like, great. I never have to come to that scary-ass post. And he's like, nope, just once a month to fill out your end-of-the-month paperwork. And I'm like, cool. So I'm there working stuff that the sheriff's deputies work, but the big stuff, right? The bigger stuff, because I can provide the state police help at that time. Now they're self-sufficient, but then they kind of needed this. So I fall into this case that he gives me. There was this legendary dude. I probably shouldn't say his name, but first name, Randy, this guy. I can remember before being a cop, this guy's name being thrown around as this legendary old car thief. You know, he had this ring of people, stolen cars, all this shit that he was into, and he was rich and all this stuff because of it. And I get a little way into that guy handed to me. So they end up making it an auto theft case and temporarily assigned me to auto theft. And I'm like, this is cool. Cause I can wear like, they're undercover guys kind of. So I'm like, oh, I can wear jeans every day and a ball cap. And they're like, yeah, hang out the suits for, you know, about 4 or 5 months. You're working with us. And it was, I was doing surveillance. We got an informant worked in with them. So he was going in and selling stolen shit. And, this case snowballs into this big deal.
And was this Larry? Was this guy kind of untouchable, or had he done time?
Okay. Every detective for the state police had ever passed through sitting that desk that I was now sitting had tried to put this guy away, and nobody could ever do it. And I'm like, here we go. You know, I'm gonna make a name for myself. And no credit to the auto theft guys; they were doing most of the work. Right? They had adopted the case, but I'm a part of it, and. We take this guy down, and I forget, like, we had all these storage units, and they were just knee-high piled with motherboard computers from cars. We'd have the National Insurance Crime Bureau guy run it, and it'd be every one of them stolen. We just found all kinds of stolen shit. So finally, we get this guy jammed up, and come to find out, our informant had fibbed about a couple things that were used in the affidavit for the very first search warrant.
No, an informant lied.
Oh, right. Imagine that.
I am shocked. Could have knocked me over with a feather.
Right. And this guy was rich as hell, brings in some like Matlock looking attorney from Tennessee. This guy's high priced bow tie, you know, just snuck up on you like a boa constrictor with that Southern drawl. Like, how you doing, boys? And then before you know it, he's got you bent over a table, you know. Tied down, you're like, all right, just let him free. And that's what happened. They dropped everything. The judge dropped everything because it was all fruits of the poisonous tree after that first search warrant. And but I'll tell you a story later that'll be important. That one experience in getting a relationship with that CI changes everything for me way down the road. But I got to work murders there, right? That was the important thing. Like, I became a detective because I wanted to work murders, and we didn't have a homicide unit like big city departments have, but I would see guys catching murders and working them. And of course, those usually go to the vets in that post first because they get the most experience. But I got to work on a few murders.
Did you have a dedicated homicide unit, or did everybody just catch the cases as they came in?
Yeah, our general crimes detectives would take them, and you know. One good thing, you get well-rounded in that spot because you work everything from a check fraud to a murder and everything in between. But bad thing is we had no true experts, you know, on homicide. Like we have in a big city where a guy's on his 50th homicide, he's pretty sharp to, you know, what to do. But we all ours got solved. They were great cases. This one in particular that takes me back to this informant, I was still a young detective. So, you know, I had my role as that. The older guys would clearly let me know that I was on this gravy train they didn't appreciate by getting to hang out in the county. It's this cool assignment. I have to catch all these bullshit cases that they got to catch in Indianapolis, right? Because they're getting leftovers there. When you're assigned Marion County, you're getting cases that either happen only on state property or the Indianapolis Police Department didn't want for some reason. And I'm getting the, you know, gravy train ride and cherry pick my cases down here. So I get up there, we have a murder, and I get called in for it. Now the body was found in a rural area in a cornfield, this woman, the neighboring county to my county. So a whole nother district than Indianapolis. And we get a call that, you know, they were out, that district's detectives were out all night in this cornfield working. Well, this girl's from an area inside Indianapolis. And they ask us if we will go execute and serve the search warrant at her house while they're doing other stuff. So we do. And we have a briefing 2 days later with this prosecutor in this rural county. And when we show up, the detectives at this other district had not scratched one piece of paper. And we had, you know, all this evidence. We had our ducks in a row. Because my boss was a legend. So we had our stuff tight. So this prosecutor is like, well, guess what? I think this murder probably happened in Indianapolis, and I'd rather these guys work it. So this unit is now working the murder, even though it's in this district. So we're like, cool. That's what the state police is all about, right? We work anywhere in the state. So we get the murder, And we find out quickly that this woman was living with this biker fiance, and they had recently broken off this fiance relationship. So, of course, now we got our suspect, right? We got to find this biker dude that she just broke up with. And
his name wasn't Lou, was it? Lou.
He definitely looked like somebody Lou would be hanging out with. I can tell you that. I find out, and I'm the young guy, so I would yell out these ideas at the table and they would just look at me and then go about their business. But I find out that in the county I'm assigned to, in this little town of Morristown, the town marshal had stopped this guy a few months earlier, and he had a handgun, no permit. He didn't arrest him, but he cited him with a summons to appear in court for the misdemeanor charge of carrying a handgun without a permit. Well, I'm also there at the table at the briefing looking at his criminal history, and he has a bank robbery conviction, among other felonies. And
so
I'm
now
like,
he's a felon in possession of a firearm.
Yeah. So I finally...
Why,
like,
is that a novel idea to some of these guys?
Right? So I kind of say, hey, can everybody stop talking for a minute? I have, a good idea. And they're like, what? And I'm like, what if, because of his criminal history, I go back to my prosecutor and I amend these charges to now a Class B felony of felon in possession of a firearm, which is not a bondable offense. And we put a warrant out for this guy for something he can't bond out for.
As you continue to make your case. Yeah.
Yeah. So it kind of glossed over it. And then it kind of becomes another guy's idea somehow. And my buddy, like the second youngest guy, gives me an elbow when now it becomes that guy's idea. And he just starts laughing. But anyway, I said, so then I'm like, all right, you're going to steal my idea? Well, how about this? Let me complete the idea for you, because you didn't let me finish. I said, I have an informant. Me and Ken Houck from Auto Theft have an informant from back in the day who is currently in jail because he screwed up after he screwed up our case and he's arrested. But he is this guy's same age and also has a bank robbery conviction. And if there's one thing I know about JR, he definitely has these problems. But if this guy gets purposely housed with him in a cell, and this guy says anything we can use against him in this murder, JR will immediately reach out to me or Ken Houck through the jailers. They'll send us a message. So they're like, all right, cool. Now, of course, legally, we could not let JR know. Right, because then he's acting as an agent of the police, and he's already proven that he's a liar, right? So for entrapment purposes, only the sheriff knows. He arranges, once this guy's caught on his warrant. By the way, when we caught this biker on his warrant, she was sexually assaulted during the murder, so we got to do a rape kit on him. And so when we go to that stage where they got to pull down their pants and you got to yank out.
Let me guess. He shaved himself, didn't he?
He had not shaved himself, but this guy, very well endowed, by the way, has his penis is completely 100% tattooed with fish scales, which, according to him, he had done in prison. He got a prison tattoo covering 100% of his hog with fish scales.
Oh,
and I'm like, this guy definitely murdered this woman, right? Like, this guy is
anybody
a problem.
Anybody who can do their own self-tattoo of their Johnson in prison.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
It was probably, it's one of the things that's burned into my memory forever from my career. I'll never unsee that giant tattooed penis that looked
fish.
Like a fish.
The one-eyed trouser trout with all the scales.
Right. So, he gets transported to this jail, and the sheriff covertly makes sure he's housed with our guy, JR. 2 days later, Ken Houck gets a call from the jail that says, hey, this guy says he has information for you. So Ken Houck calls me, and he goes, do you know what's going on? And I go, yes, I think he's going to have information from our murderer. They're housed. So I tell him the deal, and he goes, oh, shit. Well, let's go down there and talk to him. So we do. And even though previously, we could never use this guy in court again, right? Because he's perjured himself before. He has information that only the killer would know. Because when they process the body, she had these two little burn marks in the back of her neck.
And that, was your holdback information.
Yeah, we can never explain, but certainly never released, right? And he said, this guy tells him that he hit her with a stun gun in the back of the neck and incapacitated her, and then played whatever games he played before he finally killed her. Oh, and that he had made a garrote, a choking device out of an extension cord and two laundry sticks, like stain sticks. And that's what he killed her with. And there were ligature marks. And he said that he hid the garrote and the stun gun underneath some insulation in the attic, which meant we missed that in the search warrant. So we went back with a new search warrant, get in the attic, remove all the insulation, find the garrote, find the stun gun. And of course, from there, it's got his DNA on both, all that stuff. And this guy ends up pleading out in court, you know, halfway through. The state went, and then when it was defense time, he interrupts his attorney, stands up and says, Your Honor, we might as well get this over with. I'm guilty. I plead guilty. This place is full of snitches. Fuck it. Take me to prison. And it was over.
Well, at least he saved the taxpayers a little bit of money.
Right? Yeah, it was like the coolest. That was really my first experience. Like, oh, this is real. You know, like we're really affecting lives with this shit. Like this is, we're really doing important work. You know?
But normally those Perry Mason moments don't happen in court. You know, it's just so for him to stand up and go, hey, all right, it was me. Let's cut to the chase. It's like, wow.
I guess it was hilarious. I wasn't there that day in court, but my counterpart was, the guy had the lead on the murder, and he said it was the funniest thing he'd ever seen. He was just like, this place is full of snitches. Fuck it. Send me to prison. I'm guilty. We're done. And his attorney just threw up his hands like, I guess that's it, Your Honor.
Well, once you make an admission like that in front of the judge or the jury, it's hard to take it back. It's like, well, my client didn't really mean that. Well, that's what he said.
Right.
Oh,
it was great.
And how many years were you on when this case happened?
Not very. I was probably only a detective, maybe less than 2 years when that happened. So I still haven't reached my 5-year mark as a cop when that happened. That's why at first they weren't really paying attention to me.
Hey, I don't want to jump ahead too far, but when you mentioned the stun gun, it reminded me of the other story we have to ask you. So I have to ask you, when did this occur? And we'll bring it into the proper time. When did you get indoctrinated with the taser?
So one thing about the Indiana State Police is they are slow to get new equipment, right? We're really behind the times. And we got all these fancy big money departments all around us up here. And they would always get stuff way before we did. Well, everybody had tasers except troopers. The troopers here didn't have tasers unless you were on a tactical team. Like our SWAT guys had them, right? Well, at the end of my career, I get this cool job in the electronic surveillance unit, basically hunting down fugitives via their cell phones. And we were considered a tactical team because we would serve our own warrants. We'd kick our own doors for the most part. So because of that, our department comes out and says, you know, our boss is like, hey, you're going to have to start carrying a taser. And we were like, two of our guys already had it because they had previously been SWAT. Well, I'm like, what? So what's that mean? I got to start carrying a taser. And they're like, that means you're going to have to be certified to carry that taser, which means you're going to have to be tased with that very taser. And I was like, we need to stop carrying tasers. Like, I don't like this idea. Like I've got to be hit by, you know, I have to have whatever I'm carrying as a tool to protect myself on myself.
Do you shoot me with my own weapon or beat me with my own baton? No. So why do we have to do the taser?
Exactly. Yeah. Like I've had this gun since the academy and I've never had to be shot with it. Like I can still define in court that yes, I realize it hurts, you know? So I go to the certification thing and it, you know, it's a big spectacle. Whoever's been, I don't know what it's like now, but this was new to us. And they make a big deal out of it. And there's probably 30 of us, you know, are there. And because they just gotten a new batch and certain people were now getting them. And we sat there with like everybody that is waiting after you to be tased. And by the way, I just watched the first guy get tased. I go second because I'm like, I'll get up there. I'm going to get it over with. First guy gets tased, who is a rookie. And at this time, I've been on maybe, you know, 18 years. And he's a fresh boot rookie. And the rookies were, that was part of their thing, was they were going to start being issued them right out of the academy at this point. Slowly integrate them to the troopers. So this rookie's up there, and he is a nephew of one of the guys that I used to work with in the drug section. And he gets up there, and they tase him. And he makes no sound. He doesn't, like, tense up. He just, like, falls like a sack of potatoes to the ground, like, loose. Like, it didn't even look natural. It looked like in a movie when you can tell they're using just a doll of some sort that they throw off the cliff, you know? He just, boom, boom, to the ground, and then he starts making these weird sounds, like, and his eyes are doing weird stuff. And then I can see the instructor that tased him start to panic a little bit, like, I've never seen this before.
Now, was this, like, were they doing the dry stun, or did they shoot him with the darts?
This was, yeah, with the prods and the wire, you know? And I can see him, the panic over his eyes, and I'm like, I think this might have gone. He might be dying. Like, this is a big deal. And everybody, it was definitely quiet. Everybody's like, is this guy, does he have a heart? They say it doesn't bother your heart, but are they wrong? Like, did they just kill him? And then he comes to, like, weirdly, you know, and he's all embarrassed, and he's got, like, slobber all over. And he's like, I'm okay. And they're like, boy, we've never really seen anybody react like that. So then he's like, okay, who's next? And I'm like, I got to go next after that?
I got to go pee.
I got to go pee first, yeah.
So I'm like, Jesus Christ. I had watched the videos of other people, you know. So I'm like, I had had a plan where I'm just going to, you know, clench up, and I'm just going to take it. Like, I'm going to kind of just, you know, my fist clenched. I'm going to get up on my toes. I'm just going to bear down and ride it out. It's only 5 seconds.
You're going to be a tough guy.
Yeah, I'm going to be the tough one.
Ride the lightning, like they say. Yeah, ride the lightning.
So I get up there, and that's my plan, and they hit me, man. And that's exactly what I do. I'm just like, and I'm probably looking pretty cool, pretty tough for like 4.9 of the 5 seconds, right? So for 4.9 of the 5 seconds, it's just I'm just kind of taking it, you know, all clamped up. And then with 0.10 seconds left, you can hear like this little fart comes out. Like, and not like, you know, it wasn't like a manly fart either that I could brag about the next day at lunch with my friends. It was just this little like it upended in pitch, like it was asking a question. I don't like my ass was trying to handle the situation for me, like, hey, stop, you know. So yeah, that was my experience getting tased. And I'll tell you this, and this is part of a joke.
No, the biggest thing is, was it on video? Do we have it on video?
It was definitely on video, and I have been trying to find that sumbitch because I wrote a comedy bit, which really I didn't have to write. I just told what happened, and it's part of my album. And I'm like, man, if I could get that video to release on like social media with that, it'd be great. But no one can find
it. Todd McComas rides the lightning for 4.9 seconds.
That's where I heard the story. And our listeners, you can Google Todd McComas, and this skit is on there. That's where I heard it. That's why I wanted to tell the story.
It was great. And also in that skit, this is true. I mean, this real at that class, at the classroom portion of it, like after you've been tased and all this stuff, they tell us the story that is meant to educate us. But, you know, I am a comedian at this point. I was a comedian during like the last 7 years of being a state policeman and detective. So I just heard the comedy and what they were telling me. And so they tell us this story about this Amish guy. In northern Indiana, there's a lot of Amish, right? So they tell us this story about this Amish guy who had committed some high-level felony and then flees from the police in this Amish buggy. So first of all, you got to picture this police chase, like this, you know, police car following this Amish buggy. And there's like nothing you can do. You know, how frustrated are you as an officer in this pursuit?
You can't really do a pit maneuver on a buddy.
You can't do a pit maneuver. You can't throw stop sticks down. You know,
but I can tase the horse. Watch me tase the horse.
So something happens, and eventually, I don't know if the horse just got tired, but the chase ends. And this Amish guy fights the police, and one of the cops had to tase the Amish guy. And what I tell people is, you know, it doesn't matter what purpose they were telling this story. All I heard when you tell me that the police had to tase this Amish guy is there's nothing that's happened in the history of our planet that's more ironic than an Amish guy being forced to comply by the use of electricity. Like, that's the greatest thing I've ever heard in my life.
But you know what, Todd, I listened to that skit also. And have you come up with your invention yet for stop sticks?
Oh, yeah. No, but I will one day. But the problem is limited market. We could probably only sell this in parts of Pennsylvania, northern Indiana. But I want to invent Amish stop sticks. And it's just a rope with a bunch of carrots tied to it. Throw it out in front of the horse and hope that he's hungry. You know.
Well, Todd, do you know what goes clippity clop bang, clippity clop bang, clippity clop bang?
What's that?
Drive by shooting in an Amish community. I've been waiting to tell that one.
Finally, you get your moment. That fit perfectly.
And I just need to apologize to all our listeners for Morgan telling the joke there.
Well, look, where I was a trooper at, we didn't have the Amish, but we had Mennonites. So, you know, kind of an offshoot. Yep. So they were a little bit more modern. They would actually drive cars and stuff. But being up here and close, you know, we've gone through some Amish communities. And yeah, it's, I like that. Nothing more ironic than the use of electricity to stop a non-compliant Amish man. Yeah.
I just started laughing when they're middle class. They're like, what's so funny? I'm like, is nobody else seen Narnie here with what he just said?
Well, let's rewind a little bit because I want to get into where you started discovering this funny bone of yours. But there's a couple other things we want to talk about because we weren't going to talk about like any one big case, but although there are a couple of them were, but you had a couple others. So give us as you move up through your assignments, you were general detective. What's the next assignment you take on after being a general dick?
Well, you know what was cool? What got me my next assignment was we worked an actual kidnapping ransom situation, right? And it came to us. I was still a district detective. I'm still a district detective, but it came to us from our drug guys, our undercover guys. The lieutenant of the drug section had this friend who was very wealthy, and that friend calls him and says, "Hey, I just got a call from some guy claiming to have my daughter. He's kidnapped her, and he wants $250,000, or he's going to kill her." And of course, when you hear that, coupled with the fact, you know, by the time they come to us, they're like, "Now listen, you know, she does have a drug history, da 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 da." So when I hear that, I'm like, okay, she's trying to get money out of her dad, you know, as part of her drug problem. But you still got to work it in case you're wrong, right? So we set up, and back then, early days of tracking phones, these calls were coming in on a payphone, right? So one of the tech guys with the drug unit, he was set up with the phone company, and he was actually at the dad's house with something set up on the line so that they could identify the locations where these pay phone calls were coming from. So we were all set out. District detectives were set out in the cars, like just kind of like just in case. Undercover guys are out everywhere. And the plan is the next ransom call will call out the location. If you're close, run to it, right? So we had that whole part of town kind of infiltrated with us and undercover guys. So a couple calls go. We get there late. Obviously, guys, we get there late. There's nobody there. On like the third call, which the guy says was his final call, me and another guy are on our way to that station. I see the station. There's no car at this gas station. But an Indianapolis copper who's involved calls and says, "Hey, the carload of these dudes just passed me, might give them a look." So I run and catch up to the car. I got my buddy with me. We light it up, pull him over. Another detective comes us back up. And these guys, there's three of them, three black males, and they have in there pepper spray, which we knew that the dog was pepper sprayed. Their story's for shit right away, right? And they had something else I can't remember that kind of tied to the kidnapping, the scene. So right away, I'm like, hey, where's the girl? And they're like, we don't know what you're talking about. And I'm like, all right, let's toss this car. So exit circumstances, we toss the car. We find a hotel key in the middle console. So I hand it to one of our drug interdiction guys in uniform, and his name is also Todd. And I said, Todd, I'm going to have to handle these guys. We're going to take them to the post. You assemble a team and go to this hotel. And it was the old school, you know, unlock the hotel room numbers on the key. Assemble a team. Hit this room. Fuck it. Go. So they go. And he grabs a couple SWAT guys and whatever. And they hit this hotel room. And sure enough, this girl is duct taped up in the bathroom. And there's a guy holding her at gunpoint in there. And later says, yep, I was told I was supposed to kill her if they didn't call me back by this time. And so we actually like saved this girl from death in a real ransom kidnapping situation. So I end up, the case is mine to walk through court. I take this all the way through. It's a pill, all that stuff. And the lieutenant at the drug section has a particular fondness for me for what, you know, I did to help them with this case. And when they get an opening at the drug enforcement section, he calls me and he says, hey, I think you'd be good for this spot. I'm not going to tell you you're going to get it, but you're going to get it if you put in for it. And I put in for it and I got it. So I spent a bulk of my career right there, either working undercover or in the tech unit, you know, with the secret devices and car trackers and
the secret squirrel stuff. Because yeah. You were talking about earlier, I mean, one of the things that's, I mean, it's in the news, so it's not like we're giving anything away, but Harris L3's, you know, got the, you know, they call them the stingrays. They've got the cell site simulators. I mean, there are a lot of ways to really track people and do stuff. And people realize, even, but here's the amazing thing though, Todd, even though people know it, guess what? They still do. They still get on their phones and they still do this shit.
We got really into wiretaps, right? Because there was a time that I had to have shoulder surgery, and I was down for a good while. And they put you on light duty, what we call light duty then, and you just do administrative stuff in the office. And I was like, I hate this. I'm reading through case reports, whatever. I go through I unlock this room I'd never been in our office before, this little closet thing. And I see all these computer terminals, all this cool stuff like there, and there's boxes around it. So I go to the guy that runs our tech unit and I say, hey, what's all this stuff in that room? And he goes, oh, it's our wiretap system. And I'm like, what? We have a wiretap system? And he goes, yeah, we got a, you know, we wrote a grant like a couple years ago, $500,000 worth of stuff. We got this, you know, it's the old voice box system. And, yeah, we could do wiretaps theoretically. We've never put the stuff together and tried to do anything with it. And I'm like, man, I am down for a while. How about I get all this stuff out? And I go through the manuals and I learn how to use the equipment. And he's like, yeah, knock yourself out. We had a maintenance agreement with VoiceBox, so I could call to ask any questions, whatever. Well, I learned how to use the system before I'm back to 100% in full duty status. So before you know it, we set up our first wire room in there. And we wrote our very first affidavit for a mobile phone wiretap, a cellular wiretap in the state of Indiana, me and another group of guys on one of my buddy's cases. And we just hit the ground running from there. We end up with two wire rooms before I left, and the wiretap system got lumped in with the electronic surveillance unit, which is where I finished. So I couldn't even tell you how many, every wiretap they had, I had to be part of because I was the system analyst. I knew how to do all the analytics.
So this is kind of one of the things we learned from talking to some of the other feds, especially Murph. Feds would love to have the state do the wiretap as opposed to the feds having to do. There you go.
I did so many wiretaps for the ATF and DEA because DEA, you got to get OCDF approval, right? You got to go through all this bullshit. And here they're like, we can just do it on a state level. That's fine.
Oh, yeah.
So especially ATF because for some reason, our district attorney's office wouldn't put up a wiretap on any ATF cases. So they would just bring them straight to us. And they had cool cases because, you know, they're dealing with violent people. Like, you know, like they brought us this one case and two guys that were big, high-level drug guys were in business together. One set up the other. Like, we heard the whole thing unfold. He set up one for his little crew to go rob him. And so he shows up with all this dope, gets robbed and shot, which was not in the initial plan. He's in the hospital. We hear the whole thing, like, you know, being set up. So now, like, we got this guy set up for this shooting. Guy lives, gets out of the – they always live. Bad guys never hardly die when they shoot each other for some
That's
reason.
The truth.
Right? So he gets out of the hospital, and then our other guy is kind of playing these head games with him. Like, we're going to find who did this. And the whole time, like, we know he was responsible. And we're thinking, don't fall for it. It's like a soap opera we were watching. We're like, come on. I hope this guy figures out, you know, it was him, his buddy that got him shot. Next thing you know, he's talking on the phone to one of his buddies, and he's talking shit about having got away with this. And then next thing you know, we hear, like, the phone cuts out, like, weird sound. And he's like, I'm shot. They shot me. That guy had his crew come shoot the other guy, like, for revenge, you know? That's what I loved about wiretaps. Like, there was this whole soap opera every time caught up in your, you know, your crime. You know, who was banging who, you know, was screwing over who, like, all these little details I just loved.
Well, and you're getting the inside information on the criminal organization, which, you know, it's like opening up a special box of information that now you're, you know, balls of wall, full speed ahead. Here we go.
Right. And you know better than anybody, I mean, your time in the DEA, like, there's no better way to understand why crime exists than getting inside the head of these high level drug dealers, because those drug organizations basically fuel, what, 90% of crime? You know,
Drugs is involved in almost everything.
Yeah. I mean, you take away your serial killers and your passion murders and all that stuff, you're left with crime that goes back to high-level drug trafficking.
Hey, players, that is the end of part one. Part two comes out, as always, on Tuesday. In the meantime, go check us out at Game of Crimes on Twitter, at Game of Crimes Podcast on Facebook and the Instagram. Also, go check out our website, gameofcrimespodcast.com. We've got a lot more information there, including our book list. Any book written by our guests will be listed there. In the meantime, go check us out also, patreon.com/gameofcrimes. It's where we put a lot more content you won't hear on our regular podcast. We go into a lot more topics, and folks, it is a lot of fun. So go check us out, patreon.com/gameofcrimes. In the meantime, everybody stay safe. We'll see you tomorrow for part two.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar. With a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry, IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20.